Been some discussion of late on when PSA testing should be done and what the results actually mean. Larry Mueller here taking a closer look at those guidelines with our guest, Dr. David Pallone. He's an associate professor in the UW Department of Urology, specializes in erectile dysfunction, stone surgery, and urologic cancer. You may have some questions about your own PSA results, or maybe wondering about how often should you get screened for prostate cancer. I hope you'll join in our conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. David Pallone, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Lots of recent changes in the prostate screening recommendations. Can you talk about what these changes are and what they mean?
Yes. So prostate cancer screening using the PSA has been available for nearly 30 years. And you know, very commonly done throughout the 1990s and the 2000s. But about 5 years ago, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is a group of primary care providers and experts in preventative medicine, took a look at prostate cancer screening using the PSA and decided that the risks of it outweighed the benefits. And so they gave it a D rating, meaning it should not be done. But just more recently, they re-looked at some studies and were open to some opinions from the medical community about that rating and switched the rating to a C rating, meaning that there is some potential benefit, and so men should have a discussion with their physician about the risks and benefits of doing PSA screening for prostate cancer for that individual man.
The you know, you think about PSA screening, it's not a difficult thing in terms of risk to the individual, at least physically. What are the risks?
Yeah, I mean, so the test itself is simply a blood test, but that blood test could open the doors to a number of procedures and surgery or other treatments that could have some consequences. So, for example, just the mere fact that the PSA is elevated might lead to a prostate biopsy, and that's obtaining some tissue from the prostate to see if there's prostate cancer. That has risks of bleeding and infection, an infection that could be serious enough that someone could be in the hospital for a few days receiving very potent intravenous antibiotics. And if they are found to have prostate cancer, then treatment with surgery or radiation could have some pretty significant effects on their urinary function and on their sexual functioning. So that one simple blood test does have some potential downstream consequences, and that's why it really is crucial to do the PSA testing for the right man and really interpret the test very intelligently and wisely.
It's interesting. How does the decision get made then? As a physician, you have conversation with the, like, if I came in to see you, you and I'd have a conversation about whether or not to do this, or how?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the foundation of what the new recommendations are, is that rather than just telling a man, oh, you need to have this test because it's going to help you, it's more of a shared decision of, let me offer you this test. Here's the pros of doing this test. Here's the cons of doing this test. Here's why it may make sense for you, especially if you're a man between age 55 and 69 in good health, or here's why it may not make sense for you, if you're too young to really gain any benefit or too old to get any benefit from it. So it's really just a discussion of what the pros and cons are, and then a shared decision between the patient and the physician to whether or not to get that test. And then the result of the test could lead to, obviously, a whole other discussion.
Yeah. And at you mentioned 55 to 69. What about somebody who's 70 or higher? You're 69, more than 69. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I think that a lot of men, when I you know, if I've been following them for their PSA, there comes a point where I may say, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense for us to continue to check it. And I know a lot of men are taken aback by that because, what, I'm not worth, you know, looking to save my life? What's going on? But it's really that the prostate cancer in general is slow-growing enough for most men that once you start to get to a point where just statistically your life expectancy is not greater than 10 or 15 years, then it really doesn't help us to be searching for a disease that may take more than that time frame to be life-threatening. So that you're more likely to be harmed once you start to get into your 70s with getting the PSA because it may lead to false positives. We may find a prostate cancer we didn't need to find. So generally, it's, you know, not advised to do it after age 70, but I would say for a man who is in his 70s, who is in very excellent health, who has a family history of longevity, you know, his father lived to be 98, grandfather lived to be in his 90s, you know, siblings that are older that are, you know, doing great in their 80s or older, then I think, again, it's the shared decision-making, having a discussion about, okay, we can get this test. Do we really think it's the right thing to do? And for some men in their 70s, it is the right thing to do.
Yeah. Andy in Utica has a question for us, a different question, but that's fine. Hi, Andy. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a question. I'm between the 55 to 60-some range. So next year is my 10-year anniversary of having a colonoscopy, and I happen to go to Dr. Zorba as my doctor, and I remember 10 years ago when I drank that fun silver liquid and how tough that was to do, is I remember him mentioning that, oh, in 10 years from now, they'll have just a blood test that'll be able to do that, so you won't have to. He happened to mention to me in my physical that next year when I do my colonoscopy, oh, sorry, you still got to drink that. So I said, Doc, you told me 10 years ago it was going to be a simpler test. So, Doc, is there, or is this still the best thing to do, obviously?
Yeah, so colon cancer screening is a little different than what we're talking about in terms of prostate cancer screening. You know, so that's something that I would have to defer to a non-urologist who does that. But, you know, from what I do understand, that there are some tests that can potentially be less invasive than colonoscopy for looking for colon cancer. For example, something called a virtual colonoscopy, which is a CAT scan type study. I've had some patients who I've noted have had that. But you would have to ask Dr. Zorba about specifically to colon cancer screening, what would be the best advisable thing to do.
All right, there we go. Thanks a lot, Andy, for calling. You can join in, too. Taking a look at prostate screening and getting a little update on that and other issues relating to men's health, especially in the urologic area with our guest today, Dr. David Pallone. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Is there a correlation between an enlarged prostate and prostate cancer?
That's an excellent question. So the only real commonality between them is that both are more common as men get older. Now, beginning around age 50, men's prostates start to grow. We don't know why, but it's a very consistent finding that we see. And so as men get older, the prostate gets bigger. And how that affects our prostate cancer screening is that prostate enlargement causes a rise in the PSA. More normal prostate tissue will lead to a higher PSA. So that's one of the things that makes it more challenging to define just the men who have prostate cancer. You know, when their PSA could be up because the prostate's enlarged, then they may have a negative biopsy. Prostate cancer is also more common as men get older. And in fact, by the time men are in their 80s, if you did an autopsy on every single man who died in his 80s and looked at the prostate and looked very carefully for prostate cancer, you would find it in the vast majority of men. But not all those men are dying from prostate cancer. The majority of them are dying with prostate cancer. So both enlargement and cancer are more common as men get older, but one does not lead to the other. Just because you have a large prostate doesn't mean you are inevitably going to have prostate cancer, and prostate cancer doesn't necessarily cause urinary symptoms. That's more likely prostate enlargement. So the real only commonality is just they're more common as men get older.
Let's go to Joel in Milwaukee. Joel, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My experience has been that when I was 68, maybe, I had prostate or PSA tests, and they had reached a level of about 4-something, and we did a biopsy at the VA. And I chose watchful waiting over many years. And I think it was about the 5th or 6th year that the PSA level reached about 10, 11 or so. And we decided to act, and I had external radiation. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's always an option to, when discovering there is a, you know, slow-growing cancer, not to do anything, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, that's an excellent point. So just because a man has prostate cancer identified on his biopsy doesn't necessarily mean that he needs immediate treatment. And, you know, for a lot of patients, it's very confusing because here we are doing a blood test looking for cancer. Cancer, obviously, a very, you know, concerning, threatening word. And so we'll do a biopsy, we'll find cancer, and then I'll tell him, oh, but don't worry about it. That's hard to, you know, to reconcile that. But for a lot of men, if they have the slowest growing variety of prostate cancer, doing nothing may make the most sense. And I would say we're not necessarily doing nothing. When we do active surveillance, a key part of that is the word active. So we're monitoring the PSA to make sure it's not going up like yours did. We're, in many cases, repeating the biopsy, you know, sometimes within the first year to make sure we didn't underestimate exactly how much or how aggressive the prostate cancer is. And every few years, we may do another biopsy. But the whole goal of active surveillance is to just make sure we're treating the prostate cancers that need to be treated, that we're not taking men who have slow-growing prostate cancers that would never have been life-threatening, and putting them through treatment that could have the consequences of difficulty with, you know, their urinary symptoms or erectile dysfunction.
We will take a quick break, and then we'll be back with our guest, Dr. David Pallone. Stay with us. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at some aspects today of men's health with Dr. David Pallone, an associate professor in the UW Department of Urology. His clinical specialties include erectile dysfunction, stone surgery, and urologic cancer. So great to have him with us. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And let's go back to the phones and to Dan in Toma next. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great.
I had a question. Do you think prostate cancer is caused by less sexual activity since it's on older gentlemen more than younger ones? Because that's what I was told by a doctor.
Well, there's really no known cause to prostate cancer. And there's certainly a genetic component because we do see a higher risk in men who have relatives who've had prostate cancer, especially a more aggressive prostate cancer at an early age. There was one study that did suggest that men who had ejaculated more frequently when they were younger seemed to have a lower risk of prostate cancer later in life. But any kind of retrospective study like that, it's hard to interpret and say for sure that that's a real finding. So I think sexual activity does not necessarily correlate with one's risk of prostate cancer. And again, I think that the main things are just simply getting older is going to increase your risk. And if you have a strong family history, that can increase your risk. And men with strong family histories don't necessarily have to follow that 55 to 69 rule. So I think somebody whose father was diagnosed, say, in his 50s and had aggressive prostate cancer, that person maybe, and even in their 40s or early 50s, should have the discussion at least with their provider about getting the PSA testing and starting prostate cancer screening earlier than that 55 to 69 range.
There we go.
But like I said, the doctor told me what you just basically said, and it's not saying it's guaranteed, but he just said that he feels like it's a basis for it. How about that? I don't know the word.
Sure.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you so much. You mentioned fathers. What if you've had, someone was wondering, what if you didn't know about the father, but two brothers have both had prostate cancer.
Yeah, I mean, that's any kind of first-degree relatives, so, you know, father, uncle, brothers, that's important. And if somebody's brothers has had two brothers who've had prostate cancer, I think he needs to, you know, certainly have that discussion with his provider about, number one, getting screened using the PSA, and number two, maybe doing it earlier than he would have otherwise had he not had that family history.
Frank emailed to say that he had a biopsy 8 to 9 years ago, and the doctor is watching it. Do biopsies need to be repeated at, say, 10-year intervals or upon a spike in the PSA?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So active surveillance as a concept is still relatively new, and so there's not necessarily agreement among all urologists about exactly how to do it. You can't open a textbook and say, okay, here's the plan for if we diagnose with, you know, somebody with low-risk prostate cancer, what do we do to follow them? I think there's some general consensus that definitely want to follow the PSA, and if the PSA spikes or shows that it's rising, you want to reevaluate what their prostate cancer is and what it's doing. But I think certainly when somebody has a biopsy that shows low risk, meaning slow-growing prostate cancer, I personally believe you need to have another biopsy within 3 to 12 months, independent of what the PSA does. Even if the PSA drops on follow-up, you need to have another biopsy just to make sure you did not underestimate what they have. A biopsy is a sampling, so it's possible that what you think that you found isn't truly representative of what the patient has. They could have a more aggressive cancer or a larger volume. You simply missed it with the biopsy. So I think, number one, if somebody wants to do surveillance, you need to get another confirmatory biopsy within 3 to 12 months. And then if that confirmatory biopsy also shows, you know, a small amount of cancer or, in some cases, no cancer on the repeat biopsy, then I think, depending on the patient's age and health, you do want to consider repeat biopsies every 2 to 3 years to make sure, again, you're not underestimating what they have. So certainly somebody who starts active surveillance at 69 or 70, maybe only one biopsy, you know, by their mid-70s, and if that doesn't show progression, they may not need another one. Somebody who starts active surveillance at 55 is in great health. That somebody is going to be followed very carefully and probably is going to have a number of biopsies every 2 to 3 years, just so we don't lose control of the cancer and we still can intervene and cure it if it shows signs it's getting worse.
Yeah. John was wondering if, aside from prostate cancer, are there any other problems associated with enlarged prostates?
Well, the number one thing that it can do is cause urinary trouble. I think that's, you know, the thing that we think about the most when a man over age 50 comes in and is having symptoms such as getting up more at night to urinate, slower stream, frequent urination, urgent urination during the day. The major culprit to that is prostate enlargement. Now, that being said, not every man who has a big prostate has urinary symptoms, but for those men over age 50 who do have urinary symptoms, the majority of the time it's going to be caused by prostate enlargement. So that's really the consequence. And fortunately, we have a number of both medical and surgical treatments that can help improve those urinary symptoms if a man does find them bothersome.
And someone else was wondering about other major health concerns in your areas of expertise that men should be aware of.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. One of my, you know, specialties in terms of men's health and erectile dysfunction is, you know, looking at what someone's risk factors for those conditions can be. So erectile dysfunction really is a barometer, in my opinion, of a man's overall health. So when I see a man with erectile dysfunction, I think about what his risk for diabetes is, what his risk for heart disease is. Because if he's having issues with the blood flow to his penis, he may be at risk for having issues with the blood flow to his heart. So high cholesterol, high blood pressure, there are a number of medical conditions that can lead to erectile dysfunction that may not yet be diagnosed or recognized in a man. But when he comes in with erectile dysfunction, it's my job to look for those things to see if he has greater health problems that we need to address in addition to the problems with the erections that he came to see me about.
Let's take some more calls. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's go to Mary in Milwaukee next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Another amazing subject, and thank you so much for the service.
Thank you.
My husband is a prostate cancer survivor. About 9 years ago, he endured a prostatectomy. There was no radiation, but he does suffer with some ED. And, well, he's But after the surgery, it's a traumatic blow, and it affects the family, as all cancers do. But I was on the receiving end of some unwanted abuse. Our lives changed. We used to be a very amorous, very busy couple. We're in our 60s. And that stopped for us. And I brought it up to his urologist, and it wasn't funny when we went to the exam, and he's holding my husband and saying he's uncomfortable about speaking about the behavior. There needs to be counseling, not offered, I believe, but mandatory for people going through this and any other procedure that could change your life forever. We're fine now, but I don't, I've heard this. We're not an isolated case.
Yeah.
And I just want that addressed.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So, prostate cancer, number one, could be life-threatening. But even in those situations where a patient is cured from it, the cure could have some impact on his self-image and his, overall, well-being because of that impact on his erections and on his urinary function. For example, some men have incontinence after a prostatectomy or other treatments for their prostate cancer, and that can be a real blow for a man to have to address that with pads or diapers, and that's going to affect his well-being. He might be prone to depression because of that, and then obviously erectile dysfunction is a couple's disease, so it's not just affecting him, but it's affecting his relationship, and so that's why it's very critical to think about that when we treat men for prostate cancer and to let them know that we have treatments available for the erectile dysfunction. A man doesn't have to live with it. We have medical and surgical treatments that can help restore sexual functioning in those men who are treated for prostate cancer and hopefully maintain that healthy relationship that he has with his partner.
Yeah. Mary, thank you for bringing that up. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to know that things are better for you and your husband. Now, I want to give Marsha in Oshkosh a chance to join in. Marsha, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have six brothers, and my dad had prostate cancer, and two of my brothers have prostate cancer. A different brother has had melanoma, two separate sites, and I was just in for my physical, and we end up talking about family history quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And my doctor mentioned that he read something that there was a genetic link between prostate cancer and melanoma, or that there could be, and I wondered if you had heard anything about that or what that would mean.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So we're finding, as we understand the human genome better, and how prostate cancers may be related to certain genetic mutations and certain genes that control one's risk for prostate cancer, that there may be some commonality to a genetic effect on certain genes on other cancers besides just prostate cancer. For example, if a man has multiple female members of the family who've had breast cancer or ovarian cancer, that may affect his risk for prostate cancer. I mean, you could say, well, he doesn't have breast or an ovary, but there could be the same underlying gene that's responsible for all those cancers. And so it is very important if you have male family members who've had prostate cancer that you'd have to keep that in mind, that may put you at higher risk for other types of cancers that are unique to women.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling, Marsha. Mike in De Pere, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Some brief history. I'm 62 and have had high or just beyond high normal PSAs for the last 2 years, so those have been getting checked regularly, and everybody's watching it. Mm-hmm. Brother had diagnosed with prostate cancer last year. And then end of May, I had a large kidney stone lithotripsied and had a stent in for 6 weeks. About a week after the stent was removed, had some severe urinary symptoms, difficult urination, burning, weak stream, and so forth. Went in for a PSA, and urinalysis showed extremely high PSA levels, about 10 times high normal. And the urologist suspected a prostate infection, currently taking Bactrim for that. But my question is, does a prostate infection increase a future risk of prostate cancer?
That's a great question. It doesn't look like it would, but certainly it can confound prostate cancer screening when the PSA is checked whenever there is any inflammation or infection in the prostate. And in fact, sometimes if we suspect that the PSA was checked when inflammation or infection is present, we'll simply recheck the PSA before going on to do a biopsy. And I think that's certainly something that patients should ask the physician after a PSA comes back high. Do we think that this may have been related to inflammation or infection? I may ask men, okay, when you were having that PSA check, were you having any new frequency, urgency, burning, anything like that? And if so, then rechecking it before doing a biopsy may make sense. But in terms of infection as a cause or a predisposing factor for prostate cancer, I'm not aware that's possible.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Ed in Lodi, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Yes, I wondered if the doctor would elaborate on the treatments for urinary incontinence or trouble urinating. Mm-hmm. I'm 76, and I just wondered.
Yeah, so in terms of urinary incontinence, after prostate cancer treatment, there are several surgical treatments that can help with that. There, the one that is the most definitive is something called an artificial urinary sphincter. So this is basically a prosthetic device that serves to function as the sphincter. It's implanted surgically. It's all self-contained within a man's body. And it's composed of a cuff that goes around the urethra that squeezes down on the urethra all the time and prevents urine from leaking. There's a little pump in the scrotum that allows a man to open that cuff and allow him to urinate. So that's really the most definitive way of helping a man who has a lot of problems with leakage after prostate cancer treatment. But there are also some what's called sling procedures that are similar to a surgery that a woman may have if she has leakage of urine with coughing and sneezing, that can also be done in a man to try to support his urethra better, compress it, and keep him from leaking. In terms of urinary problems from prostate enlargement, there are medications that can shrink or relax the prostate that can help improve his urinary habits, and there are surgeries that can remove the obstructing tissue to allow him to urinate with a better flow, and that usually translates also to a reduction in frequency, urgency, and getting up at night. So, definitely have a number of options available for problems with slow stream and obstruction, or the opposite, where there's leakage because the sphincter is no longer working well after a prostate cancer treatment.
Are those sorts of treatments generally covered by, and we're talking about older folks, by Medicare or Medicaid?
Yes, those are generally covered.
Thanks again, Ed, for calling. Dennis in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. I'm a 75-year-old male, and I have an enlarged prostate. Mm-hmm. About 4 years ago, I had something called a green light treatment, which is performed with a laser,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't work. In fact, the prostate is to the point now where I had a cystoscopy about a week ago, and the doctor couldn't even get the probe down through the passage. So we're going to go ahead with a vaporization treatment, TURP.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, is this a common surgical treatment, and what are the risks?
Yes, so with any surgery to go in and remove the obstructing tissue, there is a risk of some of that tissue growing back, no matter what technology is used, whether it's to vaporize it with a laser or surgically resect it in what's called a transurethral resection of the prostate, or TURP, because we're not removing the entire prostate. We're leaving the shell of the prostate behind, and in some men, that tissue that's left behind could grow back pretty rapidly. I mean, there's a reason it grew and obstructed the urine flow to begin with, because it just wants to grow. And so after you remove some of the tissue, what's left behind can grow back, you know, pretty rapidly. So that's certainly a risk of any kind of procedure to address prostate enlargement, is that the tissue could grow back. We hope that it grows back slowly enough that a man only needs one surgery for the rest of his life. But definitely some men need to have another one, or even another, you know, two after it, because it keeps growing back. Other possibilities of scar tissue formation. So whenever you operate on the inside of the prostate, there could be some scar tissue that forms that creates a narrowing between the bladder and the prostate, something called a bladder neck contracture. That's something we see. You can get scar tissue in the urethra just from having that scope in during the procedure. It's called a urethral stricture. Leakage of urine and problems with erections are also potential risks anytime we go in and operate on the prostate, even if it's just to hollow it out and improve urine flow. Those are less common than some of the other risks, but certainly something to bear in mind.
Thank you for that question, Dennis. Let's go to Saul in Maquanigo. Hi, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Hi, doctor, and thanks for having me on. I take dutasteride to reduce the size of my prostate. Mm-hmm. Seems like it's working pretty well. And I was told I should take it forever, and that if I didn't, there'd be some complications possibly. I'm not fond of taking medication, especially forever, and was wondering if there's alternatives to dutasteride, and I could take the answer off
air. Okay.
So that class of medications, you know, finasteride and dutasteride, or two of them, are called 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, and they work in the prostate to basically shrink it, and on average by about 25%. So it's a great treatment for men who have larger prostates, but there are some potential side effects, you know, often sexual side effects with that medication. And some men just don't want to be on a pill, you know, every day for the rest of their life in order to help them urinate better. So the main alternative, if a man either isn't getting satisfactory symptom relief from medications, or just gets tired of taking medications, or has bad side effects of medications, is generally surgical, to go in and find a way to remove that obstructing tissue, either by vaporizing it or surgically resecting it. So that would be the main alternative to the medications, is going to be surgical.
Are there some other medications, pills and so forth, that people can take to reduce, to increase the capacity for not having to get up every 3 hours to go to the...
Yeah, definitely. So there are basically three classes of medications that we can utilize when a man has urinary problems. So the one I just talked about shrinks the prostate. The second is something called an alpha blocker. Flomax is probably the most common or popular one that you hear about. That relaxes the prostate. So there are some muscles interspersed within the glandular tissue of the prostate, and that class of medicine relaxes those muscles, and that reduces the outflow. That's the theory of how they work. Doesn't affect kind of the ongoing growth of the prostate, and so some men will actually eventually outgrow the benefit they get from that type of relaxing medicine. But that's an option. And then another medication class that we sometimes forget about, because we don't use it as commonly in men as we do in women, but overactive bladder medications can be very useful for men who have urinary symptoms, because they could have a component of overactive bladder on top of their prostate enlargement. And so there are a number of medications in this overactive bladder category
that will work. Oh, here we are out of time, Dr. Pallone. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I hope we have a chance to meet again and talk again about this. Dr. David Pallone from the University of Wisconsin Department of Urology, our guest.